honorable members, I hope that it won't take long for honorable to make a statement. I think we've got all the right to begin, because if I'm here and Kumeli is here, obviously others are coming. I don't just know, Kumeli, you are keeping the rest of the members having a serious caucus. Now it looks like don't have caucus if LI event is dissolved. So we are in correct numbers now, honorable members, and welcome from your research, from your hectic program of oversight. I'm not sure that it stays the same with myself. because mobilization. Okay, but welcome from all those refugee activities. We are back to square one in Parliament, and then we have to actually deal with the matter of the business of Parliament. And one of the business that we have in front of us, honorable members, is that we should finalize the refugee bill, because it needs to go to the National Council of Provinces, that they must have their time as well to compare with us. The sooner we finish it, the better. If it needs to be, then I think maybe we should have what we call some sort of a special meeting this week, which we may call for some 30 minutes and then just hear from the mandate that we may be having after we consider the submissions that have been made. Now, some housekeeping. I think the Honorable Kenya and Honorable Nephew, they've apologized for attending this meeting, and maybe they are still having an over of the overnight activities. Let's hope that sometimes they will join us, but for this meeting now they've apologized. Then on our agenda we've got only one item, the Refugee Amendment Bill 2015. And then members will remember that we did gazette the bill and then the invitation for the public to make some submissions, and then we are aware that they've done so, and then I've been informed that we have received at least seven submissions, and the bureaucracy of this committee, I think, have looked at those submissions, and probably then, and also they have been emailed to members. I'm sure now it's maybe more than 5 days into the hands of members. One just hope that members have had an opportunity during their hectic period of oversight. But what we are going to do is that we're going to ask the content advisor to actually just talk to what those submissions are actually saying. Remember that others have written very long submission, but I mean, it's, when you look at them, you see that much of what is on the paper is noise and very little is substance, and then we just need to talk to the substance and remove the noise. And then, I hope that the content advisor will help us to isolate noise substance and have some sort of deliberation. And of course, I'm aware as well that. The department is represented, and also from the legal department of Parliament, and then there is representation. And then we are having that support continuous until human peace. And I have seen Chibu. I think I can remember that from now. Chibu, I think, is the chair of that people, yeah, has got interest because he's the one that was taken to court, I think. And, honorable members, welcome again, and then those that are participating, I think I'll be informed if there are other guests that you've invited other than interested parties. Without much ado, honorable members, is that you remember that the draft bill that we put together, mainly we have just simply regurgitated the constitutional text to ensure that we really don't have quite a lot of problems, and also we provided a transitional arrangement. And of course, is that in relation to the 2008 Amendment Act from the department, I think we need to really get a final waiver. When is it coming to life? And then we can't just continue with that particular piece of legislation lying dormant somewhere else when we have spent money to actually put it together. On the basis that it was required and forced to solve certain things, that all of it, I think, does come back. I think we will need really to get it from the department. What are their intentions? Whether you want us to actually repeal that amendment act, or we want to still want it to be valid. We need to be forced. The department has come up clear on that amendment act. But then, in the meantime, we have made that provision for transitional arrangements to actually accommodate this particular scenario. And can I then, on that score, honorable members, then I ask Adam to really just take us through those submissions that have been made. Welcome, Mr. Chief.
Thank you, Jefferson. Good morning, guests and honourable members. I believe you have this document in front of you. So to be presenting from the Word document, there are 7 submissions, of which only 3 are really substantive. Let's go through them in order. I'm going to skip the introduction, which is basically the process we've followed so far. They're in no particular order, but I'm going to deal with the ones that have specific mention of sections of the or clauses of the law that their suggestions are for changes. The first is from the Agency for Refugee Education, Skill, Training and Advocacy, also known as the ESTA. They indicate that clause 1 dealing with section 215A of the Act, subsection permits public access to the Refugee Appeals Authority hearings if the asylum seeker gives consent. ARISTA recommends that this clause be revised to require the asylum seeker's written consent rather than have it be left undefined or ambiguous, and that the consent may constitute the implied actions that are or implied actions or uninformed consent by refugees. So they say that there needs to be more specific consent required. The second concern in terms of that subsection is that the Refugee Appeals Authority have the authority to open the hearing to any member of the public or media, and access. The question is whether the asylum seeker should be given the option to specify which members of the public and media they consent to attending the hearing, rather than just having the appeals authority decide who is relevant. ARISTA suggests that the appeals authority may, on a petition and on conditions it deems fit, allow any person or media to attend or report to on the hearing. To the best of the knowledge of ARISTA, the subsection does not clarify whether a person can only attend the hearing, or may attend and report on the hearing, or if it's only members of the media that can attend and report on the hearing. So the concern there is that other people come in, other people also allowed to report on it. Second clause, or clause, the same clause, but dealing with section 215B of the same draft clause. As the subsection is written, it gives a great weight to public interest, while other key aspects of the asylum seeker's confidentiality, including protection of identity and risk to life, are merely listed as relevant factors, and this is in their opinion. The amendment should clarify that the Refugee Appeals Authority may allow public access only if it finds that it that it is an exceptional circumstance in which the public interest exceeds the essential aim of the Act to protect the asylum seeker and the integrity of the system. The amendment should also include a clause that allows a review process whereby the asylum seeker may appeal a decision to grant access without their consent. Such review must become must come before the member of the public access to the hearing. So basically they would say there would be a contest when public access is granted for an interview, or allow the asylum seeker to contest that access. Arrest also recommends that Clause 5B be amended to read as all relevant factors, including but not limited to. So you'll remember in the draft bill, there's a list of various things that need to be borne in mind if somebody is given access to the hearing. And in the opinion of Beretta, including isn't sufficient, they should say all factors, including but not limited to, so as to allow for a broader inclusion of other factors that must be considered. And that the word including isn't sufficient. And then also, inserting the word providing, there is no serious possibility that anybody's safety may be jeopardized if information were to be made public. So this is, again, it's taking what is mentioned here and making it far more, like we're trying to be more specific about it, but basically it's similar to what's already written there about the need to protect the identity and dignity of the asylum seeker, and also the life or safety of the asylum seeker and these methods, which so is referenced to it already. They just want to make it more specific. Then they have an administrative concern, which relates to whether the RA, the Appeals Authority or the Appeals Board, will be overburdened, since they're already overburdened with applications, and whether the additional administrative task of dealing with media or persons trying to access hearing will create further work for an already overworked body. Then the second concern comes from the Mail and Guardian. They basically resubmitting what they submitted in the court proceedings, which is a different wording of the same of section 215A of the Act or clause one of the bill. In such a way that I think kind of gives more precedence to public interest. Their suggested wording is here. They say it is appropriate to adopt the interim wording. It is inappropriate to adopt the interim wording of the court, given the limitations in defining the specific manner in which the appeals board should exercise its discretionary power. In order to strike the appropriate balance between the asylum seeker and the public interest, they submit the following wording. And I'll quickly go through it. The confidentiality of asylum applications and information contained therein must be ensured at all times, save that in proceedings before the appeals authority, the appeals authority may, on application of its own accord, allow any person or persons attending a hearing subject to conditions determined by it. In determining whether any person or persons be allowed to attend the hearing, the appeals court shall have regard to the following considerations. The attitude of the appellant, who shall be given the option of wavering confidentiality. The need to balance the interest of the appellant in retaining confidentiality with the public interest in full disclosure of the evidence that is led at the hearing. The need to protect the integrity of the appeal proceedings, the identity of the appellant, and the extent to which he or she may be considered a public figure. They specify also that this is different from the court version, where the need to protect the identity and the dignity of the asylum seeker. As opposed to their already well-known status. The grounds advanced for gaining disclosure or for refusing it. Whether the information is already in the public domain, if so, in what circumstances it reached the public domain, including role, if any, played by the appellant in placing the information in the public domain, and for how long and to what extent it has been in the public domain. And the impact of the disclosure or non-disclosure on the fairness of the proceedings, the rights of the appellant. So in contrast to the first submission, this seems to be kind of moving towards more of the public interest. given that some information about already in the public domain is already in the public interest and the general direction of this rewording. Then there are a couple of submissions relating to the entire bill that we presented. Cassato basically just generally supported, saying that it's in line with the Constitutional Court, that including transparency and accountability, and safety and security and public interest. So they support it, but they also voiced the point that the DHA failed to implement the recommended rulings themselves within the GF period. The Law Society also indicated support for the general provisions in the bill. So Human Rights also supports the bill, but are disappointed that, again, that the department failed to adhere to the court ruling to introduce the legislation within 2 years as required. They also encourage Parliament to be vigilant and ensure that the DHA lives up to its constitutional legislative obligations, given an emerging pattern of non-compliance with court orders by the department and officials. So that's just a general concern about legal proceedings of the department, responding to court orders in the department. The Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office, basically expressing concern at the long delay of the implementation of the 2008 amendment, which established the Refugee Appeals Authority, which still hasn't been brought into effect due to the non-publishing of the regulations. There's also 2011 bill, which also hasn't been enacted or enforced due to the lack of regulations, as the chairperson referred to in the beginning. They urge that no further delay takes place so that the amendments can be passed in time for the 27th September deadline. And then the last one is from the Journal of Child Welfare. And they say that the Children's Act brings specific requirements in terms of children who have to give testimony or be part of judicial proceedings, and that this should be included as part of this process. And that there's a general lack of this in legal processes in South Africa, and that the OAB should bear this in mind. And they say that there should be emphasis on providing that no media should be present at hearings as a child, which appellant or the applicant is a child, that the media should be recruited from public information that could lead to the identification of a child appellant, that the provision should be made for proceedings concerning children to be held in camera or in private, and that in the event of presiding appeal board member, that the presiding appeal board member is of the view that a child's testimony before the appeal board would result in an undue mental or emotional hardship, that the child be entitled to testify through an intermediary. And lastly, that appropriate resources should be made available to facilitate provision of the above. Okay, so that means there's additional capacity needed for supporting children in the hearing. The real question relating to this is if this is necessary, if it's actually a privilege, if there are actually children who are being dealt with by the appeals authority in the absence of their parents at all, and if there aren't already provisions to account for this at present. So that's basically just a summary of the submissions, the main concerns. As I said, the three main ones being from Arresta, Million Guardian, and then the Church of Child Welfare. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any opportunity that we can have your summary printed? I think I'm revising that one page. One page or two pages. I think I'm missing that page. Yeah. I came to the first time before the coverage. I never knew that you have prepared any other countries outside. Oh, this one. Honorable member, I think we have had Adam. You're taking us through the submissions. And I hope that because of the maybe art, the departments, I'm not sure whether the department will do this, the submission in time. You have looked at them. And if so, then you can take us on and then ask your opinion with some of those
Thank you. Yes, we received the comments or the submissions. I'm going to ask Simone Malakate, he was on the comments for us. Chair, I don't know if you want me to address the issue about the 2008 the Amendments Act and the 2000 at this point in time before we start with that, just to indicate where we are in the process.
Well, if it is going to affect this particular bill, then you must make a decision now. But if it is not going to affect, you are not going to actually bring it to life before we finish this one, then you can do it at the end.
Let me do it at the end then, Chair, because it's not going to affect us. I'll only pay attention.
Let me proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, we did receive a public comments and we did look at them. And on clause one, the submission from the Joburg Child Welfare, the input by Joburg Welfare to compare the refugee and asylum terror to the child victims in South Africa. We analyzed, as I do, under section 153 of the Criminal Procedure Act, as supported. However, we are of the view that this perhaps it could be part of the RAP rules as it's more process than a legislative issue. On the submission by the Law Society of South Africa, we have noted the submission because it's not a substantive, it's simply to say they support the bill as the amendment, the proposed amendments that they are in line with the Concord decision on the Chipu matter. The submission from the Parliamentary Liaison Office, where from the South African Catholic Bishop Conference, where they indicated that they welcome the opportunity to comment on the bill and applaud the effort to bring the refugees in line with the Constitutional Court. We've noted that. Where the Catholic Bishops' Conference indicate that this amendment does well to balance the privacy and security issues. We have noted that also. And effectively, we noted and somehow agree with the submission from the Bishops' Conference. Although we are of the view that the amendment bill does not seek to effectively make this temporary reading into permanent, but in order to bring the refugees in line with the Constitution. Then we further agree with the submission from ARESTA on subpart 5A that, of course, we need to start returning the return of hand from the asylum seeker where the RAP is considering an application for a person to appear or to attend the hearing. But we are of the view that it's more of a process issue again, that perhaps it could be dealt with in terms of the RAB rules rather than being provided for in a subclause as submitted by a resident. Chair, over and above that, we simply have noted and have also agreed with the submission that has been made. There is not a substantive submission that the department has made in this regard. That is.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure, honorable members, maybe to get Mr. Chipu, and then because there is an assertion, but or maybe just simply to get since this particular ruling, what have been your experience in regard to disappearance and how you've been handling them, and what is the workload that you have, and just give us your experiences since this particular court ruling. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chair, and honorable members. I think we had only two applications that we have received in terms of access to appeal hearings. But what we have tried to do is to, I mean, yes, normally the respondent, I mean, will be the asylum seeker. They will normally refuse not to give consent. But I think we need to understand that in terms of the constitutional law, I think even though the asylum seeker can refuse, I mean, there are people, they still have to make that decision. In terms of public interest, I think that's what comes more in that constitutional decision. I would agree, because, I mean, if it comes to written consent, then it's probably, there isn't anything that you're going to do, because it means the process now relies on the asylum seeker, rather than the applicant who wants access to the appeal hearing, because the access would be either, because, I mean, if we grant access to appeal hearing, it would mean there would be conditions when it comes to certain issues. Either you might not reveal the identity of the person you can report, you might not reveal the physical address of the person where he is. Unless if such information already is in the public domain, then there isn't anything that why we should put a condition around those issues. But I think also, yes, I feel about such a huge volume of work because of backlogs that we have due to lack of capacity within the refugee appeal that has been going on for many years. Well, I don't see that much that will happen in terms of application being made in terms of access to appeal hearing, because most of the cases, if you look at it, is more of prominent so-called asylum seekers. That will be information already in the public domain, then that's where media and print media wants to come and be part of those hearings, because they feel like, I still remember the argument that was put clear before the justice, in the constitutional control, and the issue of saying, how do we know that along the way there's an influence that can be coming from this asylum seekers because of their prominence. So I don't envisage that we have such a lot of application coming in terms of access to appeals. Thanks, Chair.
You're saying that the workload you have, you cannot directly say that it may be the consequence of this particular court ruling in terms of the access to those affected by media. Since then, that the court has ruled that you should have that capability to proceed.
No, I wouldn't say that, Chair, because the backlog has been there for some years. It's not a question that is related to issues of access.
Okay.
Yes.
And then have you ever handled anything about children?
Yes, the lesson that we normally children as individuals, we have had most of their cases, because mostly they will come as either accompanied minors with their parents. So normally then they will be within the main applicant, would be the, an adult. So we haven't dealt with issues of children. And normally I don't envisage that if they will be, because then that will mean that such children will be either under guardian as directed by the legislation that they need to go to children's court and apply to have guardians. Such other guardians, then they will have to be part of such hearings so that we do such matters.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. There was one proposal from the department. One proposal. My document. There is one proposal on page 3 of our draft bill. Sub D. At the end there, that the Refugees Appeals Authority concludes that it is in the public interest to allow any person or the media to attend or report on his hearing after taking into account all relevant factors, including but not limited to from the department, have you ever looked at that, and then have you tried to analyze what are the indications of adding words like that to that, and does it improve anything? Does it create problems? I mean, we just want to just hear from you from your side, because the members are able to take you on and inquire issues, the many political issues. Yes.
Thanks, Jay. That was a suggestion made by Arresta, if I'm not mistaken. What they're trying to say, Arresta, is that it should not be an exhaustive list. Now, the word including at the end actually indicates that it's not an exhaustive list, but if you, that's there in the bill already, but if you add the word but not limited to, it just makes it absolutely clear that it's not an exhaustive list. So it's neither here nor there. It doesn't make it good, it doesn't make it better. It's for us, it's just a question taking on board comments here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I agree with what Mr. Advocate Erasmus is saying, that the word including means that the list there is not an exhaustive list, it's not a closed list. It means that the refugee appeal board can include any other factor in addition to this list. But if one looks at paragraph 47, even of the judgment, the cheaper judgment, where one look to see whether the word but not limited to should actually be included. My view is that the word but not limited to would be superfluous. And if we follow then the readings or our constitution and our benchmark, and as part of our 47 of chief of judgment, they look at section 36, which also has that wording which says including but not, which says including, but it doesn't then go on to say but not limited to. And the court itself then says that at paragraph 47 in the chief of judgment, it says that it should be noted that the five factors expressly itemized in section 36 are not presented as an exhaustive list. So if we take our view from our mother document, I would argue as to not putting the word but not limited to. It doesn't create any harm, but it would be superfluous, I would say.
Well, that's
why
sometimes we're saying okay. Have you done to your credit science put your understanding on the submission? Because I want to turn back to talk to this submission and even bring some politics to them completely. Okay. Now let me get to the members now. I'm sure you have heard this. There is a summary of the submissions that is done by your staff, but also the hard copies of the submissions themselves. And then we have heard the department has tried to look at those submissions. In general, they are not fighting this submission. They are just simply isolating others. They form part of the rules that govern the appeal procedure rather than policy matters. So, but in general, they are not having hard feelings. This is where they some other try to throw stones at the department. I'm sure it's they are not still a bit loose, so they are angry about the case. I mean, it is that honest. You can't bring an amendment to Parliament and then you process it and approve. Then that leads you to the state. That's something you can do. Honorable members, Honorable Hussein, will be followed by Honorable Tickler. Then Honorable Maxson, Honorable Gumagan, then Rafika, who will close out at the other end. In that part.
Sure, thank you, Ganesh. I take it that at some point we're going to go through line by line on this thing and deal with it. If that's the case, then I'm just going to raise just one or two questions of clarity before we get to that point. Yeah, I just want to hear from Mr. Tipu whether or not there's been any cases where there were unaccompanied minors.
who have applied for asylum. I mean, I heard you comment earlier that there's always a guardian a little bit, but I didn't quite get a very clear answer to that, whether or not there were any stages, at any stage, whether there were unaccompanied minors who applied, and how did they deal with that situation. Then the issue about not limited to our, I mean, I just want to say that it's really not a big issue, because I think that the word before that is taking into account all relevant factors. I mean, that's the critical part. So I'm really not going to die in the ditch to include the words not limited to this. I think it's important, Mr. Chipo made a comment about conditions, and I'd just like to hear perhaps from the legal advisors what their view is on including or granting authority to the appeals board to set aside conditions, like, for example, you may not disclose the name of the individual in the report or the identity or whatever, but a clause that gives the appeal board the authority to set conditions even after granting access. So I think it might be critical in certain instances whether the identity of the individual to protect his confidentiality is paramount, but at the same time balancing it out with public interest, where there might be a principal issue that needs to be reported on, not necessarily the individual's name. So I'd just like to hear your comment on whether or not it can be included and how it can be done. There's one thing that our legal committees have not responded to, and that is the question of and or. Arrest a submission on, these pages are not numbered, I'm sorry. It's the first, not the cover page, excuse me. The first page. What's the first page? Sorry, give me a second. Yes, the fourth paragraph. The director is rather concerned about the freedom of the subpatient release. The refugee appeals authority may, on application and on conditions deemed fit, allow any person or the media to attend or report. The argument is that it's suggesting you can do one or the other and not both, if I'm understanding the argument. So would you have a particular problem if you had to include the word and or? Does it really matter? I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that, just to deal with that part of your submission. And then the other one on the latest submission is the question of whether or not either an asylum seeker or an applicant wishing to get access can appeal the decision of the appeals board to grant access. I haven't heard your thoughts on that one. I mean, it's on the second page of your submission.
I think we must just bring the first part of the bill, the intention of the bill. The intention of the bill to amend the Refugees Act 1998 so as to confer a discretion upon the Refugee Appeals Authority to allow the public and the media access to its proceedings in appropriate cases and to provide for matters connected therewith. Sergeant Sigland.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, members. Well, actually, I'm partly covered, but I just want to find out about this refugee. Is there any outstanding applicants? And if there is it the children or the adults? The other thing I want to find out, if the applicant come with the media to the appeals board, do you allow or you send the media out? Those are the two things I want to find out. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
No, thanks, Professor. I just want to find out from the department the submission that is made by RS, how did you deal with it? Because there is a confusing part when heard by this thing. If I can read it. RS recommends this clause be revised to require the asylum seekers written and informed consent. And then it says, which members of the public and media, he or she consent to attend the hearing? So I just want to get a clarity on that one. Because according to my understanding, the public is the public. So you can't be saying you are not a member of the public, so therefore you are not allowed to come inside. So I just want to get a clarity for the department. How did you deal with that one? And the Catholic Parliamentarizing Office, I think they are genuine concern here. I also agree with them. It takes too long. I think the department also has to clarify to us, why are we not implementing this one? The Refugee Appeals Board and establish the Refugee Appeals Board. So why are we taking so long? I think it's a very genuine concern that they are raising. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I hope we are writing. We are taking notes. If you have problems, then maybe some shorthand to the courses may solve your problem. Honorable Mayor.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Firstly, let me apologize for coming late. I had an inaccurate text driver driving around Cape Town. And I'm sorry for that. Together in the plane with me, with Honorable Faye. And then, my first point, I think, is to note that no one is opposed to this in principle. There could be differences here and there, and so forth. But secondly, there are a lot of developments around issues of immigration, partly because of developments around immigrants and the issue of the colloquium that was there end of June. So there may be new developments that may come out of that that could improve this legislation or assist the department in line with the improvement of the legislation. I think therefore I support the position as it is, with the understanding that we are aligning what is there with the Constitution, but otherwise the nation is in dialogue and discussing this matter towards input into a law that is going to be much more permanent than this position. Right now, I think we've got to make sure that we comply with the instruction of the judge, and at the same time plead with the department to provide legislation as soon as it can, given the situation that there are a lot of developments. One of the developments is there's a committee that is going around borders seeing who is a refugee, who is not a refugee. There are going to be recommendations by that committee, which may enrich our approach in as far as legislation is concerned. So given that, I would propose that we stick to what we have so far, with the understanding that we are going to have further input from the department with the intention of then not only complying to the law, but acting in line with the expectation of the public out there. Because if the public is not satisfied, then we may have unrest, and normally unrest in South Africa is accompanied by violence, whatever label it is. So the nation is in dialogue. I think it is correct, and then we've got to be in line with the judgment and comply. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I was the traffic. It was not on my side, and my apology on that.
But we did hear what the content advisor said. We read the submissions from different stakeholders, and I hope that these amendments will be passed on time as requested. And it will be on my birthday. They say that should be before the 27th of September. So you must know that it must be done before the 27th of September. So it is, you know, we are trying to put our laws and rules and policies in place. And for the most important people here, it is our community out there that needs to be protected at all times. I thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Of course, that we just need to indicate, of course, that two to 3 weeks back, the department held a colloquium. The intention is that we look at this as honorable committee has been indicating. They have been indicating, of course, that they are coming up with almost a wholesale review of this particular policy. And so, in general, we can really say that this amendment that we are doing, we are just simply bringing compliance is the Concord ruling. But then we may find ourselves dealing with an extensive review of this policy very soon, maybe even towards the end of this year. We may find ourselves sitting here. Well, now the question, of course, that will arise, it will be whether do we really have to spend a lot of resources now, when we know that in a couple of months to come, we may find ourselves sitting here with an extensive review to deal with all other challenges that the department wants to deal with. Because this one is a technical amendment that we are bringing compliance to the Constitution. And then that is the one thing that we need to do. Maybe starting from Chibu, I'm not sure whether they are ready, because there were a set of questions that Honorable Hussein has actually put to you. And then if you could, if you still remember them, we can respond to them.
Thanks, Chair. I think I respond to that, and also the issue I think of sending applicants, children and adults. And my understanding is, and I think that's how we've done it, even though we didn't put it in terms of part of the rules. What we have outlined is when a person brings an they have to bring an application. Then when the applicant, either the media, that becomes the applicant, they bring an application that they want access to their appeal hearings. Then the asylum seeker will become the respondent to reply to their, on their notification, whether they consent or not consent. And then there will be exchange of documents. And after we have to look at those applications and then decide whether we are going to grant or not grant, based on certain issues. I think the issue of conditions, that has outlined, those conditions are there as stated by the Constitutional Court. Because whatever you do in the public interest, you cannot jeopardize the asylum seekers in the public. You still have to see whether there's a risk or not. So what are those issues that you need to put as conditions? And there's nothing wrong with those kind of conditions, because they'll be allowed as part of the Constitutional Court. And also, there's the issue of, I mean, when the media comes, probably they come there to report. And I mean, you can say, that is why we are saying certain things you cannot either disclose, either the identity of the person. You can't take the photos of that person if that person is not in the public domain. Why would you want to take pictures of that person and report on that? I mean, they report the information without necessarily putting the photo of the person. I think it's one of the issues in terms of conditions. But But what I've seen in terms of, I didn't understand this question in terms of outstanding application for children of adults. Is it because of someone who has applied for an appeal, or is it because someone who has applied for access to the appeal hearing? Because, I mean, we do have outstanding application in terms of appeals because of the issues that I've already elaborated in terms of the backlog. Then we still have those kind of outstanding appeals.
I think let's just find the clarity on that question. Hmm. If I understood Honorable Hussein, he's still here, and then he wanted on minors that are unaccompanied.
Yes, okay. I think I was going to that because I think I was dealing with the issue of the, I think, the Honorable is it Fikren, and then asked about our sending applications, which is, I think, the legal service will not be able to answer that question. That's the reason why I tackled that question, to understand what is it. Is it because of asylum seekers who have lodged appeals with the Refugee Appeal Board, or is it because of people who have brought application in terms of access to appeal? But I think that's the reason why I answered in a way of saying, yes, we have a backlog of our standing appeals that were rushed, because specifically because of lack of capacity. I think I mentioned that from the beginning. Then going back to Honorable Hussein, because he wanted specifically to know whether there are unaccompanied minors who appear before the appeal board. I think that's the question that he asked. To be honest, I mean, we haven't found an unaccompanied minor appearing before us, unless if the unaccompanied minor, there are two situations that have happened. I think those are recent cases where the main applicant would have died. Then now, it would mean those children were in the file of the main applicant. Then in that way, normally what we'll do, because we can't deal with the main applicant because the main applicant died. I mean, the act says they can still continue with that application. But then probably what we do, practically what we do, we refer the matter back to the department so that such children can be assisted. We haven't found just one unaccompanied minor just coming single and appeal before the people. There isn't matters like that. Most matters that come of such unaccompanied minors are either the parents died or someone returned back home, things like that. But which is, I don't think they even make a percentage of what we receive. Thanks.
All right.
I'm just going to tackle some of the legal issues that Mr. Hussein raised, but just also add to what Mr. Chief has said. The Principal Act, as well as the 2008 amendment, does have a provision dealing with unaccompanied minors. And the department can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the 2008 amendment makes it even stronger. There's even stronger protection for unaccompanied minors. Because if it appears that a child or the person under 18 is an asylum seeker, and that child is considered to also be a child in need of care and protection in terms of the Children's Act, the provision says that an asylum seeker permit must be granted to that unaccompanied minor and then be referred to the Children's Court to be dealt with in terms of the Children's Act. So I think that protection is there. Also, on the issue of conditions, can they be set after an application has already been heard? The draft law doesn't indicate that. It seems that the conditions must all be set beforehand. And I think the logical reason for that is that the appeal board must have considered all those factors. And if conditions need to be set, they should set them up front so that nobody's rights are infringed after access has been granted. And I think that's also what the Constitutional Court envisaged, that you must apply your mind. And if it means that the identity of a particular applicant should be published because there may be threat to life or harm, that's a condition that must be set before access is granted. Whether this can be done afterwards, that's not what the law allows for. I don't know if practice allows for that. On the issue of the word or being used in Section 21.5a, From a drafting perspective, the word or is seen as something which is disjunctive. What that means is that it gives you a choice to have any of those activities applied to you. Whereas the word and would mean it's a conjunctive word that is used, which connotes togetherness. So the manner in which the Buddhist drafted with the word or, it would mean that the refugee, my interpretation of that would mean that the refugee appeal board would be able to allow the media permission to attend, may allow the media permission to report, or may allow the media to do both. It all depends on the application. So I think the word or is a safer one to use instead of and, because you might just want, a member of the public may just want to attend, not necessarily report. So that's why I view there. On the issue of whether you can review a decision made by the Refugee Appeal Board, in this particular case, even in the absence of express review clauses in the Act, in the High Court, the applicants had taken the Refugee Appeals Board decision on review. And I'm assuming, and Mr. Chief can correct me, that it was done in terms of the Promotion of Administrative of Justice Act, which is in short what we call PAJA, which is an overarching act that would apply if your own act is silent on those issues. So for example, if it's the Section 6 of the PAJA, it says that any person may institute proceedings in a court or a tribunal for the judicial review of an administrative action. So obviously a decision taken by the Refugee Appeal Board could be considered an administrative action that can be taken on review. So it doesn't hurt to have an express provision, but this particular clause we're dealing with is dealing with the confidentiality of the, and it may not be an appropriate provision to provide for the review proceedings, but the department might want to include that in the amendable if they bring it. So I don't know if the advocate that wants to add in, but I think the rest of the questions are for the department.
Just before you come in, I would like also on arrest submission. The issue of informed consent and the written consent, what it brings into the whole process, whether it brings additional burden on administrative actions to actually deal with this particular matter, it brings other parties where the asylum seeker may not be having knowledge of the language that we are using here. Suppose I'm just simply saying, suppose Somalia speaks their language there, non-speak here, and then he appears to be an asylum seeker. And then if we talk about the written consent, as opposed to when he's sitting there and then he says no, or I agree, then you want the written consent, then I'm sure it's correct that that will now bring other parties to assist administratively now, like this, whatever. This informed consent, what does it mean? Does it mean that now is the asylum seeker must go to some school, some sort of NGO, somebody to go and induct or explain or whatever for that person to then, we can say that now he has made an informed consent. And then what would the impact of this kind of issues then be on the time that will take for the appeal hearing to be started and concluded, and all those other things? I just wanted to get some sort of response from yourselves.
Just from my research, informed consent would mean that in this particular instance, the asylum seeker must have the full understanding of the potential repercussions of granting consent. This would therefore mean, I mean, if we're talking about foreign nationals, they would have to be explained in their language what it would mean to give consent to allow others to attend their hearings, what it means in terms of their rights, how their rights will be affected. It's also consent that must be given freely after appropriate disclosure of adequate and understandable information in a language understood by the person giving consent. And in this regard, Arrestor, I think the RAB here might have to take measures to educate asylum seekers of the risk associated with giving consent to allowing public to attend. So in my view, yes, there would be this extra that needs to happen for informed consent.
Thanks, Chair. I think I was just adding on what the girl parliamentary was saying. In terms of, I agree with what he's saying, in terms of any administrative action that is taken is reviewable. That's the principle of that administrative law. Whether we write it or not, I don't think it's necessary even to put it in legislation. Because even within the Constitutional Court, when this matter was heard, then there was a question that was asked, what happened in instances that the RAB refused the media to attend. I mean, I do remember Justice Thomas never was saying, no, you still have recourse, you can take the matter on the High Court to review the decision. So whatever we do is reviewable. It's not something that it's just final, because legislation has never empowered the RAB that any decision that they make final cannot be reviewed by the court.
Okay. You want to comment before
the department comes on that? Okay. Yeah, I don't disagree with the legal advice as well as what Ms. Chibu says. But the issue is this for me. I mean, I agree that we must, in the interest of public, grant access and the principle of them. I mean, I completely agree. But there must also be that balance of protecting the interest of the asylum seeker. And in this particular case, the problem you sit with is that if you have an asylum seeker who refuses to allow access to the media for his own personal reasons, because he doesn't want his identity or whatever to be made public, and then the appeals board grants access anyway to the media, and then we say, well, he can now go to court. I mean, the asylum seeker doesn't have that level of access to the constitutional court. And then people need a 24 to save up the money to go there to the constitutional court, which is the reason why I was arguing for an appeal authority that will give the asylum seeker at least an additional measure of safeguard. Because he's never going to have the resources to run to the constitutional court or the high court to challenge that decision of the appeals court to grant access to media.
Yeah, I think we'll have a little bit of a debate on this particular matter. As we're saying that it looks like the authority here is with the RAB, and this bill seeks to actually empower the appeal board to have this discretion. And then now the question is, do we have to create another center of authority? That now is the asylum seeker now becomes the person that gives also the final determination. And then if the RAB takes a decision, then it says no, you don't do it. And then the matter then stands. The issue that we must have certainty who has to take the final determination, and so that they are able to move. But then if we create two centers of authority, in other ways is that while we give the RAB the discretion, and then also we really cement the rights of the asylum seeker, then we'll be having two centers of authority. And then we must just watch out that we create a regime that can be implemented and can be administered. And then conclude. I think we just need to look at that. But at the end of the day, what he said is that the appeal board must give regard to the interests of the asylum seeker. They must listen, and when they've listened, then they must make a judgment. They must make a judgment. I think that's the intent of this particular piece. And then let's just hear from the department. But all what I'm just requesting is that we mustn't find ourselves putting a policy where the appeal board wants to do this work and ask them to figure out they can stop that process and stop it completely. And, you know, it's, we may have created something that is capable of killing itself. Yes.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to start off by saying we must remember that the Refugee Appeals Board, to be named the Refugee Appeals Authority, is an independent body as far as decision-making is concerned at the end of the day. If you want to put in place another process to review a decision after the Refugee Appeals Authority has made it as ruled on this specific case, who are they going to review? To the minister? Can't happen. The minister cannot look at the decision taken by the Refugee Appeals Board. The only other option is the judicial review going to court at the end of the day. Now, if you look at the process that the Refugee Appeals Board Authority, as it's going to be called later on, has to engage on before they make their decision, they have to solicit most probably comments from the interested party. In other words, the asylum seeker affected at the end of the day, whether or not he or she indicates yes or yay or nay, they need to give reasons why am I saying yes or why am I saying no. What is the reason for me to say no? Now, those reasons the Refugee Appeals Board have to take into consideration, because remember, once they decide on that application, they give reasons why they say yes or no, why they're allowing access or not. And those are the decisions that will then, when it's taken on review, those decisions will be taken into consideration by the court or whoever to say, was this a rational decision? What's this, can this, will this hold water? So that those are the safeguards that we have in place. Thanks, Chair.
Yes,
I
think you
mentioned
the situation that we have right
now. Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just on some of the Lord Advisor of Parliament has upticked before the issues that we had quick discussion. Just on the word and or all, there's also case law in this regard where the and can be read as or as and. It depends on specific cases. But what you indicated is actually, by using the word or, it gives you more guidance. It can be either or both. Okay. That's the one. I dealt with people review the decision from the RDB grant access. You've also dealt with that in terms of FAJA. There was one question, if the applicant drops up with the media at the remember, the bill, the intent of the bill is that it must be on application. You can't just rock up there with what the RAB in this, and I'm speaking on behalf of the RAB in this regard, what they will say is, no, there's no application before me, so I can't enter, you will not be allowed access. There first has to be an application by the relevant people wanting to have access to the RAB in order to be decided upon. Okay? The delays, if I can now come to the delays, the 2008-2011 Amendment Act, and then my colleague will deal with the comments of Arresta. The 2008 Amendment Act, the Refugees Amendment Act, was attempted by the President on the 21st of November 2008. What happened in this specific legislation is we did away with the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs in the 2008. And in the place thereof, they would have worked together with the RAB. At that point, there was a transitional provision dealing with that. What then happened when we went to the portfolio committee, it was said, because what we created the internal entity is that if there's a manifesto on side of abusive or fraudulent application, there will be an automatic review to the DG now because there's no more scroll. Okay, because a manifesto on side of abusive or fraudulent application, there was an automatic review to the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. What happened now, because you're doing away with SCRA, there has to be another mechanism in place, so we said it must go to the DG. However, when we got to a portfolio committee, it was said that we need to create two distinct processes. They included a new section 24 capital A and a 24 capital B. 24 capital B was an old 24 capital A which dealt with your refugee appeals authority, which dealt with appeals. But in this changing process, in the parliamentary process, there was an incorrect reference was made to section 24.3b, small b, of the Act which deals with your manifestly unfounded abusive or fraudulent application that is now going to be reviewed by the RAA. That cannot happen. It should go to the DG. So there was an incorrect cross-reference. And whilst we were busy effecting this correction, because when we were training on the regulations, etc., whilst we were effecting this incorrect cross-reference, what then happened is, was a change in leadership as well, and additional things were added. Then what came on board was to say that we
don't want a refugee status determination officer now, in other words, an individual member making a decision on an application. We're going to include what we call the refugee, the status determination committee. But that also went through, that happened in 2011. So there was further amendments to what was already there. Apart from correct, the incorrect reference, we also had to deal with further bringing in place the status determination committee, etc. What then happened is, when we wanted to implement the refugee status determination committees, it means you had to have a quorum, you had to have additional members on those committees to deal with an application. You couldn't implement the legislation. The funding wasn't there to implement, to get the necessary warm bodies to fill those vacancies, etc. So it was a huge work. So you couldn't implement that legislation. And that brings me now to where we are now. We are currently busy with the 2015 Refugees Amendment Bill. The idea with the 2015 Refugees Amendment Bill is to bring into operate, you're going to affect all necessary amendments, additional ones as well, where we are now allowing, for instance, the REB and the SCRA to sit as individual members when they are looking at dealing with that in order to deal with the backlog issue. So a chairperson can decide in this specific instance, you can hear them as individually, so you don't have to sit as a quorum. We've had a lot of litigation in the specific area where if you sit with one or two members, you don't call a quorum. In other words, you cannot do it if the matter is referred back for hearing, and there's court cases, the law in this regard. So that's how we dealt with that. What we're doing in the 2015 Amendment Act is to take everything that was done in 2008, 2011, plus an additional amendments now in 2015. Once the 2015 Refugees Amendment Bill comes into operation, well, it will come into operation immediately after the 2008 Amendment Act and 2011 Amendment Act comes into operation. We'll bring all of it into operation in one go. And what needed to be amended in the 2008-2011 one will be amended in the 2015. So you'll then have a seamless process where all the pieces of legislation come into operation. So just as to where we are currently in the process, we have presented the 2015 Refugees Amendment Bill to the JCPS Cabinet Committee. We were informed yesterday that Cabinet has approved. The presentation to the JCPS Cabinet Committee was in order to obtain approval for the publication of the bill for comments. That has been approved. So Cabinet endorsed the JCPS Cabinet Committee resolution that we go out and publish the bill for comment. So we're now going to be in the process of publishing the bill for comment for the month of August. And hopefully by the end of September, we'll be able to approach Cabinet again in order to obtain approval for the introduction of the bill into Parliament. So we're looking at the end of September, mid-October, to introduce the Refugees Amendment Bill 2015 into Parliament.
Yeah. We find ourselves going through the next year with the deal.
Because towards the end of the year, I'm sure you know that there is a high flux of bills that come to Parliament. And one can just simply say that you just need to put your foot on the pedal and just try to run a bit faster. And if it's possible to shorten that specific time. Because it is going to take time with us as well. We're going to have all those other products of parliamentary processes. And then, and as you're saying, it is going to attract a lot of interested parties. Because if you are reconsidering every threat of the refugee bill, then you are almost saying the whole world that are affected by that bill must come and defend their current positions on the bill. And there's going to be a very long process. That's why this one we are not having so many people, because it is just talking to a specific activity which may not be affecting everybody else that have got interest in the Refugee Amendment, Refugee Act. And, yeah. Honorable Member, I still wanted from your side to talk to this specific matter. Does it look like you have got interest to talk to? This is a recommendation that the concern be in writing. If the specific Aslam seeker doesn't write, whatever, you need the consent. I mean, it is recommended that it should be in writing. And then this person doesn't write, or can't write. is a senior person, never schooled or whatever, or has other problems, or has the problems of whatever, that they cannot rise. If we bring this particular recommendation and include it on the bill that must have it invited, does it mean that if a person can't rise, then everything stops until that particular writing happens? And then I've heard this explanation on the consent that must be informed consent. Who makes the determination that this unskilled figure has made an informed consent? Who's going to make that determination? Who's going to raise his hand and say, sharp, this one is informed? At what level will that happen? Because, you know, why I'm just raising these things is just simply to ensure that you have got a system that works. And then, if we have got a system that we put stumbling blocks ourselves, and then when it doesn't work, we shouldn't clap. Because all this, that means that the question that if we include this issue of informed consent, we may find that before the RAB makes the determination to grant access to the public, then you may have a small little inquiry or court happening to determine whether that person has not is informed or not informed. Many court happening before the actual determination to give access happens. And then, like the very same one of in writing, if that writing doesn't happen, then some other activity must happen and determine why the person can't write. And somebody must make a determination whether it is acceptable under those circumstances. Because the act wants a written consent, and Aslam Sika now, when it's being asked, can't write. And then, some sort of a small mini engagement must happen for people to come to an agreement whether they accept the verbal in view of a written. And then what then happens to the time taken to really make that decision? So, because the main thing is that there's a hearing that must happen. That's the first thing that must happen. The hearing. But then if we create a lot of activities that must happen before that hearing happens, or determining the written consent, the informed consent, and somebody questioning, this one is not informed, we can't remember anybody explaining, or maybe the RAB has explained to the person, and then they realize that the person came to be knowing English, and then it doesn't know the English, which means it's not informed, it's not been explained. So I'm just simply looking at, we'll go one by one going down, and then but at the level of the impact of a recommendation that they written and informed consent, I just want to get from you legal fundis to help us out, because we happen to be lucky not to be schooled in law.
Okay, I will thank you very much for this. I will attempt to answer your question in by way of an example. The doctrine of informed consent, simply taken by way of example, is when a person goes to a hospital and the doctor says, I'm going to perform an operation on you, and the operation is going to entail 1, 2, 3, and these are the risks that are involved. And then at the end of the day, the doctor says, are you willing to go on with the operation? If you say yes, and then he gives you a form to sign. So if we take that example and bring it back to the refugee system, it simply then says the RAB now would have an administrative issue to explain to the asylum seeker to say, we have received an application by X person who wishes to be present at the hearing, at your hearing, and explain what it means and what are the risks involved. Hence, now Arrestor is saying, perhaps to show that they to show first that the asylum seeker was informed, secondly that the asylum seeker has agreed to the person to be present during the hearing. There must be something in writing indicating his intention or indicating his agreement that he has agreed for the person to be present at there. That's a way of something in writing. So, as our initial submission were to say, perhaps that can not be dealt with by putting it in a piece of legislation that we can deal with it in the rules of the refugee appeals board. The difficulty why we might have is that if we were to put it in the legislation, that becomes written in stone, it's cast in stone. It has to happen. If it has not happened, then we have a difficulty there. Hence, the flexibility could be found in the rules. Because if even when perhaps RAC deals with this matter, and they find more often than not that asylum seekers are giving them oral agreement, perhaps they would. So it's sort of giving them a leeway on how to handle that. And then perhaps, Jay, if you allow me, there was a question by Honorable Maxwell, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, as to arrest, I say, shouldn't we provide an asylum seeker with an opportunity to indicate, yes, I agree to advocate Erasmus attending my hearing, but I do not agree to attending my hearing, which goes to the person who is the public. And maybe I would be late a little, but in terms of the Interpretation Act, we do not define where that have already been defined. So the public, it means the public at large. Anybody who is interested in the hearing could have come and apply for to attend the hearing. So it's not exclusively a set of a group of persons or a particular individual, but the public at large.
Thank you, Jitai. I agree wholeheartedly with what my colleague said. Just on the issue of the written and informed consent, remember, I think it's from a legal point of view, and if you look at litigation that one faces, etc., to have something in writing is proof that you got something. If you do it orally and say that there was consent, then all sorts of things can happen. No, but I didn't say so. That wasn't the agreement. And then you've got nothing in writing to prove that this indeed that you agreed to this. So my view would be, yes, I think it should be in writing. It doesn't add to the process. Yes, it would add to maybe the already requesting that this is what's going to happen, this is going to be your repercussions, etc. Do you agree? The asylum seeker will then have the opportunity to indicate, yes, I agree. Based on the information that you provided to me, I guess it's fine. We're going to allow that. Or no, I don't feel comfortable based on the concussion. Then it's for the RB to apply their minds to the reasons given by the individual to say, yes, I think they've got a case. I can add this as a condition, etc., before we make a final determination. So it's all part of the process. I also agree we can put it in the rules, not necessarily in the act itself, because it can lend to certain difficulties. But it's the question of our alter and partner rule, where you hear the other side before you make a decision at the end of the day. Thanks, Chief.
No. But this with informed consent, you are avoiding to speak to. Is it necessary that it has to be written? Because what is the current situation? When people give consent, they give consent after somebody has said something to them. But then when you bring in the word informed consent, what I'm just raising with that word informed consent, it just simply brings that anybody can review the decision to test that this person was actually informed. And then I thought that when this word informed is brought in here, it means that this particular person should be really knowing 100% about what's going to happen. Not that this person has just been informed. It's bringing a higher level of state of mind. But my understanding is that currently, whenever you go into any, for any procedure, in surgery, of course that you have got that particular engagement, and then eventually then you give your consent. But for us to characterize it now, not just a consent, informed consent, does it bring an additional thing or not, or is that tautology which doesn't bring any other burden over the whole process? That's what I just wanted to hear from those that know the law. Because if you say it's the asylum seeker's written consent, and when you say asylum seeker's informed, written informed consent, what is the difference? What is the difference? Because we will then try to understand why Arrestor is bringing this way. Because it can't just bring it if it doesn't, make some difference. Yes.
Okay, I'm going to attempt. I think the reason for Arrestor bringing that in informed is to say that there might be a process in which the RAB indicates to the asylum seeker, like say if we use the knowledge of the operation, etc. These are the pros, these are the cons, etc. Do you agree? There's been a request. That is what informs. In other words, I've been informed of this, but it's open to interpretation. What does this information mean? If you're saying it's informed consent, what does this informed mean? So we might have difficulties, but it is just a written consent. It means that, I think Arista is saying, but it doesn't mean, doesn't indicate that the asylum seeker has been informed of his or her rights, or that there had been an application in this specific regard. So, psychology, I think one can argue both ways, and that's usually, it's difficult to say. I don't know, it's written and informed consent. I think the informed there, the meaning there is just to say, listen, we bear knowledge of this application that has been brought. Do you agree that we give this consent for the, or allow access? If you do not agree, indicate why. Those would be reasons provided by the asylum seeker to the refugee appeals board. They will then have to take that into consideration in coming up with a final decision. Tautology, maybe. If you just say written consent, I think the argument is, but you're not telling me that the asylum seeker has been informed of this, and they want to see it in legislation. But I think if one argues, that we want to belabor the point here, if you say written consent, it means that there wouldn't any of it be a process before that, because if a person gives you consent, you give you consent on something, I mean, you must know about it. So it would be information that's provided. So one can also argue that it is actually tautology. So for me, it's neither here nor there. Thanks.
Yeah, just if I come to you, honorable members, if you look at the submission of arrest under subsection 5A, it is not page number, it's just on the second page. So 5A. When you read the paragraph, the first paragraph under 5A, the context of this, arrest has an understanding that you must reach something so-called full understanding. The asylum seeker must have full understanding. And also, they are actually motivating this by talking about the committee or the RAB must prioritize taking measures to educate asylum seekers of risk associated with the disclosure. Educate, not inform, educate, school them. That's why I'm talking to this particular way informed, that it looks like Arabs are interpreting it in a manner that we may not be interpreting it the same. Because that's why I'm saying is that how do you then test that this Arab figure is informed? Who calls, who makes that call that is involved? Because the RAB, of course, is that we just sit there and then that indicates somebody is looking for access to attend your hearing, and then these are the following. It is media, they are going to write your story tomorrow, you may have your picture there, and then where you come from, whether you're coming from other country or running away from people, don't even want them to know where you are. Then the media wants to attend the writing, and those people will be seen where you are and where you are asking for answers. And then that information they'll give. But does that really amount to education? Does that amount to saying, after that exercise has happened from the IB, this particular Aslam seeker is fully informed? Then, unless otherwise, maybe this is a misunderstanding and misinterpretation from Arab. On this, for being informed, is what they are actually saying here, or a full understanding of the potential repercussions, and also whether it talks to education or actually just informing the person. And let's hear you.
Okay, thanks. I really see it as going to be a very serious problem in terms of if now we started to say that consent either had to be informed or written. Because then now, my understanding why the Constitutional Court just came to that point of saying Aslam seeker to give consent to all the RAB to consider public interest. The moment we started to put to reduce it in written consent, then that would mean you are going to have a stumbling block in terms of either making a decision. Whereas if now we are saying that the asylum seeker, when either the media or the public person has brought an application, then we inform them and say, look, the hearing will not proceed in this matter because A brought an application to have access to a hearing, and these are the documents. Because also we normally inform that A, that as much as you are going to serve us with that application, you need to serve to B, because B has interest in the matter. Then B will look at the matter and say, I do not consent due to this reason. And those reasons can't be just reasons that come somewhere else. It has to come as they are put in terms of the Constitutional Court case. So I find it very difficult that we have to look at it in the way they put it, because now you are actually putting another impediment in terms of how that process needs to go on. Because now, in a way, as Dion at one stage explained, which is what we are doing, it's a question of saying you look at all the facts that are put before you, then you come to a reasonable decision. And why I mention issues of conditions, because I mean there will be a situation where you don't agree with public A to access the appeal hearing and state the reasons why you don't agree to them being present within the appeal hearing. But then I think we should just leave it the way the Constitutional Court has done it, rather than the way now to start to say we put this in the rules. Because now if it's in the rules, it means that whatever we do, we still have to comply with the rules, because we will say, but I never gave you a written consent that the media should be present in my appeal hearing.
Okay. Honorable Hussein.
I want to disagree with Mr. Chico. I'll tell you why. If he says leave it the way it is, what he's saying at the moment is that the asylum hearing, it goes on there, it says if the asylum seeker gives consent, or the refugee appeals the policy concludes. So you can still grant access to the media even if an asylum seeker does not give you consent. That's what this thing says. So I disagree with you when you say that including the word written consent is going to be an impediment. It can't be an impediment, because the consent part is there already. And if you want to argue that it's going to be an impediment, then the fact that the consent is being granted there, and it's only an impediment. The issue is about written or unwritten. That's the issue, actually. And either way, you as an appeals authority, appeals board, you are at some point going to have some written record to confirm at some point that somebody has given you this permission. How are you going to prove it at some point? So, you know, whether you put the word written in or not is not going to be an impediment. My argument would be it really doesn't matter. You can put it in there. The impact is going to be the same. Because at some point the appeals board or the appeals authority, I don't know what you want to call this thing, it's changing name, but RAB or RAB. It's still currently RAB. Yeah. so the impact is the same. To put it in, not going to have a massive impact. Then, yeah, I just want to speak briefly on this issue of the informed consent. And where I think ARESTA is coming was on this point, and one must be sensitive to the submission on this, is the issue of language barriers. Because a number of asylum seekers won't understand a form written in English. And so giving a written consent on a form, finding a pre-designed document where a person just simply signs to say, I hereby give consent, won't necessarily mean that the person has, understands it. So I think that's what the issue is. And I would argue, Chair, it is a way in which we can accommodate it without creating a massive administrative burden for that. We must be trying to do it. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, well, I think, like as they have already indicated, that in the form of the rules that govern the procedure to do that, because your understanding, I think, it's almost the understanding that we are having, of course, that people with different languages may come here and not understand wherever they come into contact. But you see, the issue that we are raising is an understanding that talks to full understanding. You know, what is full understanding? How do you really define that? How do you attain that? You know, who makes the call that there is a full understanding? Those are the things that I'm just simply saying that we just need to really be fully aware of that and that understanding. And when they actually try and motivate that, expecting the RAD to take measures to educate the asylum seekers. You see, to inform and to educate is two different things. To educate a person, I mean, is when you've actually spoken to a person about any matter, you still have a responsibility to test that person understood that. To test. But when you inform a person, then you are actually giving the information to the person, and then you don't necessarily need to examine that person that now has understood that. Educating a person, I think, it calls a little bit more. So that's why I'm saying is our understanding is that the processes in terms of the rules, you know, they can be crafted to actually capture all those particular areas, you know, to make sure that whoever is coming here that is talking Mandarin and then within the RAB, there's nobody that speaks Mandarin. Then they will have to find a way of finding someone who can really make that translation or whatever. That can be built in the procedures and the rules. But we need really to call for the consent. And like as you say, is that written consent, and then that ordinarily is what is happening, especially the medical profession. And then, or at the hospitals, when you are actually told that you are going to sleep in there, then you have to sign some piece of paper to be able to sleep there. But the unfortunate thing is that here we're talking about people that we are not in control of, and some of them are vulnerable, and then they are not in charge of the situation, because they are actually, you know, looking for some sort of refuge or help. And then it's not like when you are actually walking into a hospital or into a lawyer who wants you to sign some proxy things there, where you are actually in charge of the situation. Yes,
you know, without wanting to belabor the point, I think we can deal with it in rules, but the other issue that one can do is if you really want to look at informed, you define what informed consent means. For purposes of informed consent means, and you cut out education, so you clearly state what it is that you mean by, that's just a matter of drafting style. If we want to make it clear, you can do that in section 1 then, but then you have to include a definition section in this act to say that for purposes of informed consent that provided for in that specific paragraph, it means this.
Okay. We agree that the issue pertaining to children is already covered in terms of the previous amendment. And again, that in terms of processes as well, can be dealt with within the rules and the procedures. Of course, the children are highly protected in the country. There's a lot of legislation that seeks to protect children. And okay, can I ask members now in a line whether there are still specific areas before we go down this particular bill line by line, and then the areas that you want to go through it? Yes.
Okay, just one matter principle. I agree, wherever we can, if it's at all possible that we can accommodate some of the things in the rules, we must do it, to not try and frustrate the process, because this process is just to name one portion. We can deal with some of the other things later on. But I want us to also avoid a situation where we think it must be dealt with in the rules and then it doesn't get dealt with in the rules. So I'm speaking now to Mr. Chipu and to yourself, and at some point this thing must happen, when, you know, that perhaps you can take the comments of the committee into account and find a way to make sure it's included in the rules if there's agreement. Thank you.
Now, as the committee of parliament, I think we have got some reasonable powers. We can ask them, when are they going to put those rules together, and then we ask them to come in and give us a copy of the rules. And then we physically see that it is in there. And then if it is not there, then we make us that run. That's it. I mean, we can ask any set of rules that the department is utilizing if we wanted to inform ourselves. The only thing, of course, is that with the rules, you know, we are actually giving policy and ask the department to actually give effect to the policy, because you can't write everything in the act. And, honorable members, okay. Like as we have said in any way, is that this is actually a technical amendment that we are just trying to actually comply with the Concord. And one may plead that maybe we should not really find ourselves cracking our heads, because of course is that the text that we had from the Constitutional Court, ordinarily, it has put a system that is in effect now, that is actually utilizing. And then, it is not actually causing harm as we're speaking now. And then, like as we have said, is that initially, that you know, it's amending, like as the Maiden Guardian is trying to raise this matter, that we should not just take the text as the Constitutional Court has put in. And then the question is, if you amend that, this particular wording that the Constitutional Court has actually read into this, are we not going to find ourselves having to explain why we deviate? Because during this specific case, a Maiden Guardian did make submission to the court, and the judgment has actually considered those submissions, but produced this particular text. And then, do we really have to rerun that particular court case? And then really say that the Maiden Guardian input, then we bring it in, because somewhere else it actually seeks to alter really what is the current text that put the system now for granting discretion. And I need to hear from honorable members whether we agree on the text that we have, that we had before, and then the input that has been made by some of the submissions, as we have studied that, then you will find some good place in the regulations, and the department put them in the regulations, and then you can come and satisfy us that they have drafted in that area that deals with children, if ever. The current legislation that deals with children is having some gap, and then putting whatever to actually cover that, and then the issue of the consent, and then on the regulations, and then how are they going to go about it, and make sure that does not disadvantage the asylum seekers. And on the current text as we have on the as our refugee bill, is there anything that we need to change? Yes.
Okay, just a minute. It's not going to be in the regulations. It's going to be in the rules of
the refugees. Rules.
Yeah, we just want to make, because the regulations are drafted by the minister.
Yeah.
The Refugees Act.
Oh, okay.
For the, yeah, so this is the rule.
But, yeah.
Just a bit, thanks.
Okay, thanks for that correction.
Honorable member, the new guidance, the current act as you have, is there anything that we need to actually do on it, or we can agree on it as is, and then whatever we have been laboring on, that we believe that it makes sense, then we go to go through. Number one, let's talk to the intent of the bill right at the top. So amend the Refugees Act 1998 so as to confer a discretion upon the refugee abuse authority to allow the public and the media access to inconvenient, inappropriate cases, and to provide for matters connected therewith. Agreed? We don't have problems with think that it is accommodating the actual agenda. Okay. And then now on section 1 of our bill, that sub 5, the confidentiality of asylum application and the information contained therein must be ensured at all times, except that the refugee appeals authority may, on application and on condition if deemed fit, allow any person or the needy to attend or report on each year. If then those are now the conditions. If the asylum seeker gives consent, or the refugee appeals authority concludes that it is in the public interest to allow any person or the leader to attend or report on his hearing after taking into account all relevant factors, including the following. Mm-hmm. Then it was Roman figure 1 and 2 is the Roman figure 6. And then, So, almost all other factors that the RNG must consider, given the condition of the situation, whatever is occurring at that particular time, that it may not be in this list. Then they will have to explain themselves if they did that if they consider that in the ruling. Because others may not be here. These of course articulated here, they almost form the minimum condition. But they may consider other conditions in their ruling which then they must explain in their when they rule. This year, we hear on this specific matter
the only one minor adjustment I would argue for is under A, that includes the word "listen." And apart from that, I'm satisfied. Hearing if the asylum seeker gives written consent or the refugee appeals authority. When we argued the point earlier, so it's not going to have a massive impact.
Well, can we really speak to it? Because what one is having here is that the refugee appeals authority will grant that access. If the asylum seeker then agrees to it, if you just walk in and then just agree, and then say, no, you can allow them in, and then you'll give access. But then, if the asylum seeker says no, then must give reasons, all sorts of reasons and explanations and the rest. And then after that, then the appeal, the RAD then must apply mine and make it terminate on that thing. And that's what I'm understanding now. On B, it's likely to talk to, the B is likely to talk to what the asylum seeker said. I mean, if he said he's not worried, and then I don't know what the RAD will be refusing for. But if he refuses access when somebody applies, because now there is a point of dispute, then now there must be explanations. That's why now it says the refugee authority concludes. That means that it has to actually consider certain things, which may be the motivation of the person that is seeking access, and then the reasons of the asylum seeker who's refusing that. Then there must be but when they reach that conclusion, then they must make sure that they consider all these things. That's how I'm reading it. I'm not sure whether I'm misunderstanding Honorable Frank.
We're on the same page. I understand it exactly how you understand it, but the reason why I'm suggesting put the question there.
Yeah.
You see, in a case where the asylum seeker says, I don't want to grant permission,
yeah,
there's going to be some written record of it. And I don't grant permission for the following reasons, A, B, C, D, E, whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then we share that with the respondent, I mean the applicant.
Yeah.
But in the case where he does give consent, then there's no written record. And I'm not sure that that's proper. Do you see the point I'm making? So if somebody simply says, yeah, I'm fine with it, I can allow the media to come in, then just had a simple form that says, I hereby give content to this hearing to be made public. I mean, that can't be a massive administrative problem.
Oh, okay. I understand what you say. Is that where the Adam Siga agrees to the access, then that the man will see the day for that. Is this not what happened now?
Yes, I think at the moment the application that we have, these are applications where asylum seekers have not given consent. That's why there are application exchange of information between the parties. But then I think even still in a situation where an asylum seeker will have given a written consent, you still have to put it on record, even though you might not elaborate like the other disputed one. Because you have to write those, the access is being allowed, because it has to be a record somewhere else. I mean, if there's no record, the moral person can just say, I've never given that consent, then can you in court, where will you, because the court will want the record to see. But you still have to do that. In terms of administrative law, you still give written reasons. It doesn't matter whether it's adverse or you agree with the person.
Okay. Well, I thought so, that where the president is expected to give them a sense, then there is somewhere to sign, something. Whether it's put stupa or the cross, somewhere there must be to sign that I agree with it. Otherwise, the president that is seeking that consent, and then if it is not done, then there's nothing, will be risking a minister. Yes, ordinarily that's what happens. I'm not sure, because Honorable Udin was now asking that we must include the word written consent. Is that what you want to do?
Unless there is a very strong feeling against it. I mean, including the word in there is not going to have a massive impact on it anyway. If it's going to happen, so.
What about when the review that deals with the rules on the procedure? Then they are very clear that the consent is in writing. Can you do it that way? So that at any given time, you know, it's if it proves practically that it creates problems, and then the rule is easy to change. If we come and make some sort of presentation, that has the quality to say, the question of getting a consent is problematic. These are the problems that we find in practice. And as I try to explain, where you've got maybe an asylum seeker that is not cooperating, but that simply says not a, you can't give them access, not cooperating in many things like that. And then it proves to be problematic. Then to come and change the act would be one of the another tedious thing. But then to change the rules, it may be easier.
Chair, you correctly stated that it's easier to change the rules than the act. The only thing that from a legislative point of view and a legal point of view that I would guard against is if you put the word written in there, it indicates to the asylum seeker that this is how it needs to be. If you put it in the rules and not in the act, people might see a loophole and say, but you're saying I must be consent. Now you're saying in the rules it must be written. Your rules can never override your act. They'll say that your rules are ultra-virus, the provisions of the Act, I'm not going to give it in writing, you won't have a foot to stand on there. Mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking about that conundrum. So if you put the words written in the Act, it's clear, it must be, whether it's in the form of a form or whatever, just say yay or nay, that is, you know that it has to be because it's legislated on. If you put it in the rules and not be in the Act, it might be open to attack. I'm just thinking. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, probably maybe you may not be covered in this thing, okay. When we say written consent, are we saying that somebody has to sign a piece of paper where he has agreed to? Or are we saying that he must bring a document then that he has signed as a submission? What is your understanding? Because I thought that the consent, I guess you have explained before, is that a doctor will just simply give you a piece of paper that has got a the procedure and the number of that procedure. After the explained to you, then it just turns the bottom that you say, no, you are proceeding with it. And then you don't sit and write some thesis or, you know, you see. So let's just understand each other. What is that? Because I'm saying that in the rules, you may explain how the consent is given. You may just say how to implement that, and then not necessarily that you are actually overriding the act, but explaining to implement how that is will be implemented, and then if they are going to draft a form, then this is the rules they put the form. It is the form that must be signed for the consent, whether agreement or refusal, then signed as complete. The writing between there and that's what I just thought it will happen. Not for a person to sit and write a submission. Unless if I understand it wrongly, you can help me with saying what you meant with a written consent. So that we have got a similar understanding.
Let me tell you where the real impact comes in.
Yeah.
Okay, we all agree, I think, that what you want to do here is balance the interests of openness, transparency and access to information. But balance that with the interest and the rights of protecting an asylum seeker. We all agree on that. So, an asylum seeker has got two options. Either he agrees or he doesn't agree to access.
Yeah.
All right. So in the case of where he doesn't agree, he gives his reason. There is a report. In the case of where he does agree, there isn't a requirement for a written consent. And let me tell you the problem that you could end up with. That access is granted to members of the public and the media without the written consent of that individual that he didn't even know about. And then somebody argues, well, he did gave the consent. And then you don't protect the rights of that asylum seeker. But if you put in the word written consent there, then there must be a written record. And if you're going to include it in the rules and not put it in the act, then you end up with a conflict, as the advocate suggested. So, I mean, it's not that I assure you, and I'd like to hear Mr. Seabrook respond to this. To what extent is it going to impact on his ability to keep up if you add the word in written there? And all it will mean is a simple, straightforward form that says, I give consent to what.
that's what I thought it happened. So then I said, maybe Chibuka can explain to us, because it, the understanding that Honorable Hussein is having is that if he's saying yes, you can allow them, that is not reduced to writing. Is that correct? Because the other meaning is that when you receive an application from maiden guardian, once accepted, then you say that that application, a copy must be given to the asylum seekers to respond as well.
Yes,
they have to respond.
Yes,
but they must respond this by saying yes, and then it should be happening in some different way.
I think here's the reason why I tried to explain the issue of consent, why it's not necessary to say it has to be written, because precisely because of that. Because the people who apply for access, they understood very well that they have to serve the other person. It's like a court process. So they still have to do that. Then parties, they exchange information and they bring to us, then we are able to deal with it. Because within that application process, the asylum seeker will still say, I do not give consent. I do not allow them to appear before. But then they will give reasons why they are saying that. In an instance where they say they allow, they will also give reasons why they say they allow the media to be present within the appeal hearing. If for us to make a decision, remember for us, we are there at the tribunal to make a decision. We are not there to fight with any one of them. That's the reason why I said the way it's written by the Constitutional Court to say consent is fine. You don't have to define it as written or not written. Because we understand that this is a process that you have to deal with. The same thing as when an RSDU has rejected an asylum seeker. The asylum seeker knows very well the burden is upon him to lodge an appeal so that we are able to look what gives us jurisdiction over the asylum seeker is because he's lodged the appeal within the required time in terms of the law, 80 days, then we adjudicate that matter. If there's no appeal lodged, that matter is not before the RSD, because that's the person who needs to make sure that he lodges an appeal and that matter comes before. It's the same thing as in this matter. That's the reason why the Constitutional Court would not want to define consent as written or not written, because they understand it's a process that you have to bring it as if you are bringing an application before the law, because it's a tribunal. That's how things work in this issue.
I hope that there is now a little bit more clarity. And what kind of record do you have when you have this particular situation arising, where there is a maiden guardian wanting access, then the asylum seeker has to agree or to refuse? What sort of documents do you have that if somebody now asks that you can open a file, what is it that you are going to find? Whether in agreeing for access or refusal for access, in RAB's filing system, what do you have under those situations?
Yes, thanks, Chair. We have documents that they bring what is, they call it an access to an adult application to appeal hearing. That's how they frame it. Then they will write why they want access. Then they will have who are the parties. They will mention the asylum seeker consent. They are the applicant. That person becomes the respondent. Then they will have sent those documents to that person. There is a period in which they need to respond, the asylum seeker. Then we will respond. Then the applicant will reply and said, these are the reasons why we want access, based on issues as they are outlined by the constitutional law. They probably would have said, in most cases, these are issues that where an asylum seeker is, this information, rare information, has always been within the public. They said, because of this thing, the public has an interest in your net. That's the reason why we need to report on this issue. So those are the documents that we have, then we'll make a decision based on that decision, any one of them who's not satisfied with our decision has the right to take the matter to the High Court. I mean, I will not say the issue of saying asylum seekers, they don't have access to the court. It's not true. I mean, there are NGOs that represent asylum seekers. Rights for Human Rights is one of them. There are many matters that have been brought against the department, brought by an indigent asylum seeker. I mean, that cannot be the argument to say to have a written consent because you have indigent asylum seekers who will not be able to brought this matters to court. And what I have seen also in these instances, courts, even though the court does not agree with the application, in some cases, courts, they don't even award cost against these indigenous asylum seekers because they understand
okay,
how such measures are given.
That argument. That one, that's problem. Let's just be one of the pieces of paper that record what they did. The response from the asylum seeker is in writing to the application. That solves the problem. Because now if the asylum seeker has to respond to the application, must indicate that I don't agree or I agree. And then the response of the asylum seeker and the application now will be sitting in front of the RAB to take a decision. That means there is record of what is happening. Yeah, that's what I'm understanding. Does that actually solve something?
I get the point you're making. As long as that in every application that there will be an opportunity for the respondent to give or deny his permission in writing. Is that the way it's supposed to operate?
That's what he
said. I think what I'm understanding is like a notice of motion application, where one party who's the applicant will file in court a notice of motion, and any response, whether you're going to oppose it or not oppose it, would have to come in writing. So I'm understanding Mr. Chief to say that even when the content comes, it would be in writing.
Yeah.
But there isn't a form that the refugee appeals authority would give somebody to sign.
No. Yes, it's an ordinary response like in a constitution. So therefore that response will be contained whether the asylum seeker is agreeing. If it's not agreeing, you'll also make it clear that I'm not agreeing on the basis of the following and then dispute some of the facts that are in that application. Then that means then there will be submission from both and you'll be knowing exactly the position of both and then you make a decision on the basis of that. Yeah, I think if that is the case, then it should be dealing with the challenge that we're having. Honorable member, can we then agree that we will vote on this? On this, what is that? Next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Then we come and finalize this, and then we go and clarify ourselves whatever we think that it is not right. But I will be the happiest. I'm losing you. All of you, I will be the happiest that we agree to the current text as it is, and then we pass this, it goes past, and then we gym and prepare ourselves for the next review of the policy on the people. Then we come and do all our best to make sure that we produce a policy that will stand the test of 5 to 10 years to come. I would look to you to do that. So that next week on Tuesday when we come back, and then we don't find ourselves just talking until cows come home, when we are still going to have an opportunity to do so. I don't know about the chickens. Well, because ordinarily chickens take a call. So I don't know whether it's unless you've maybe have got chickens that they got a farm. Okay. Are we agreed that we're going to do that and then on Tuesday then we come back and then we just come and file this and then prepare it to the SOP for concurrent? Yes.
Okay. The next step would then be that this bill must be introduced in the National Assembly.
Yes.
It hasn't been introduced there yet.
Yes. We agree. On Tuesday.
Okay.
that need to have to go in there. Yeah. Agree?
Agree.
Okay, thank you very much, all of the members and our visitors and uninvited visitors. Those were interested. I think, yeah, this is better, yeah.
Please have your name and title.
Oh,
yeah. Just name and title, please. Your full name and your position.
Do you like your time?
I don't
know. You're looking fine.